like to say, Charles, I'm going to say a few words about our dear colleague Michael Axel, who some of you know from Western, passed away recently. Michael was a very, very dear friend to all of us who work on Iran. He was most recently, obviously, a member of the BITS Council. As you know, he started life in the Foreign Office. He worked on the Iran desk. Developed a passion for the country and then decided, I think, very wisely, if I might say so, to leave the Foreign Office and go into writing about Iran in a more serious and academic way. And I remember discussing with him the areas he was interested in. He was always very interested, I have to say, in military history. He had a real passion for military history. And he decided that he wanted to look at Nader Shah and really review the biography of Nader Shah, which, you know, we were long overdue, I think, a new edition. And broadly speaking, I think his contribution, in a sense, to that sort of re-energising our look and our review of 18th century Iran history, I thought was particularly important, particularly valuable. And as you know, he then went on to write two more very, very well-received, wonderful books, one in particular, The Empire of the Mind, which was especially good, especially brilliant, probably the entry, sort of, whenever anyone says to me, I want a really good, comprehensive, thorough, sort of deep but accessible account of Iranian history from the year dot to the year dot. Empire of the Mind is, I think, the book to go to, and I think it continues to be, and it's one of his very, its lasting legacy. Now, we wanted here at BITS to be able to sort of commemorate and celebrate both his life and work, and I think what we will be doing, and Charles and I have discussed, is that there will be a workshop in his memory at Peterhouse in Cambridge in the new year in February, and I think BITS will be hoping to participate and contribute to that in some way to make it a broader event as far as we possibly can. So we'll keep you informed of those developments, and hopefully those of you who are able, who don't live in Cambridge, I mean, who want to live in Cambridge, if you want, but who don't live in Cambridge, I think we can both agree that it's better than Oxford, though, isn't it? So that's I think Michael would agree with us actually on that point. So anyway, we'll keep you updated and let you know as things develop, and hopefully as many of you can come and join us there in February 2020, I think.
Yes, well, just to echo really Ali's remarks, and of course Peterhouse was Michael's college, and he got his PhD on the basis of the books he'd written, which is one way of getting a doctorate after he didn't actually formally study for his PhD, but he submitted his book on Nader Shah and the Empire of the Mind, and he went on to write a couple more excellent things, and so he was very much involved with his famous Westphalia project as well, which is a way of looking at how the experiences that the European countries were getting through in the middle of the 17th century actually have many parallels with the current situation and how, you know, modern politics and international relations, it's not a simple one-to-one argument. Everybody gets involved, and the more you get involved, the more it involves someone else getting involved. So we're hoping that the Persian element of that project, which was very much Michael's initiative with Brendan Sims in Peterhouse, will somehow keep going. So that's enough of that. I should stand my back to our distinguished speaker. Is your father called Vise?
No.
Anyway, it's very nice for me to be able to introduce Richard, and not only because for his own personal presence and lecture, but also because he is the first lecturer now in Islamic art at York, which is a splendid result of some, talk about one man influencing history. I mean, Fosia has produced a series of Islamic art lectures at York, really on the back of her own enthusiasm, and this has, in the end, had such an impact on the management of York that they decided they wanted to promote the study of Islamic art in the university, and it's obviously a great triumph for them that they've appointed Richard as the first lecturer. Not unlike Michael, he has a career, in fact not unlike me if we're going to talk about me, which we're not. He had a career before becoming an academic, and was building golf courses in Canada. He quite rightly thought that this was a pointless thing to do. stubbing your toes on ancient artifacts by the Oxus. And so he did an MA at SOAS, and then he did his PhD in Edinburgh with Robert Hillenbrand on Anatolian art and architecture. And as you see, he's going to talk about this evening. He has a book on this topic on the way, and a book already finished, just to remind myself, on the Karakhanids.
Yes.
Thoroughly unexplored. So without more ado, Richard, thank you very much for coming, and we look forward to your talk.
Well, thank you all for coming. It's lovely to be here, especially on what's not been the nicest day. As I said, I'm in the final stages of writing the first monograph on Minaiwe, which you may wonder why something that's so relatively well known, if poorly understood, hasn't had a book on it, but hopefully by the end of today that might be a little clearer. Minaiwe is also called Haft Rangi, and it's essentially an overglaze decorative technique, which means that the painting can be added over the top of the glaze at any point between the 12th century and the 21st century, making these things quite problematic. As a result, I focus more on the sherds and the fragmentary and archaeological material rather than the sort of seemingly wonderful and perfectly, or seemingly perfectly preserved pieces that every major museum and collector has proudly displayed in their collection. Rather than try and summarise the whole book, which is always doomed to fail in the space of an hour, I'm just going to give you a quick overview for people who aren't familiar with what Minaiwe is, how it's made, the sort of general shapes and some of the decoration that's featured on them, and then look at the process whereby it went from being virtually unknown as a class of ceramics in the late 19th century right through to the middle of the 20th century, when Pinder Wilson's book of 100 examples of Islamic art in every media had a full 10 pieces that were Minai or Minaiwe related. So it became ubiquitous, yet still poorly understood. Oh, I can use this actually. So start off with, it says the 13th century. It does seem to have developed in the late 12th century. Production seems to have finished early in the 13th century. The trouble with Minai is it seems to promote far more questions than answers. There's no definitive proof as to where they were produced. There's a lot of evidence that it seems to have been Kashan and possibly Jajan as well, but we don't have any wasters or kiln sites, so the dating is problematic. A lot of the dates on pieces appear to run seamlessly across 20th century plaster fill, which again makes them somewhat problematic. But nevertheless, I'm going to try and give you a quick overview of what we're dealing with. With the exception of one subgroup, which we'll look at later, almost all Minaiwe is produced with stone paste. And you can see some here, dirty from where it's been in the ground, but if you can see where it's chipped, it's a pure white, very stiff body, produced primarily with glazed, with ground quartz, a small amount of white clay, which holds the material together prior to firing, and a small amount of ground glass, or frit, which vitrifies and solidifies the material after it's been fired. Over the top of this, we see either mostly a white glaze, tin or pacified glaze, or in a minority of cases, turquoise with the copper oxide. Almost all of the colours that you see, apart from of gold, which is applied as an element, consists of metal oxides. They're the source of the colour. So sometimes things are called sort of like their lapis colour, but you can't use a stone to make a glaze colourant. In terms of scale, this is about 5 millimetres thick. They're generally very finely made, very thin wares, with a less than a millimetre thick glaze and an incredibly thin layer, as you can see on the top of the actual overglaze paint. So you have some inglaze colourants, which are used to give large areas of colour, but the vast majority of the detail is applied over the top of the glaze and fired at a lower temperature. And this is what allows them to be touched up in a way that other classes of ceramics really can't be. It's very hard to touch up lusterware. It just will not match the same way or something like Isnik production, for example. In terms of form, the vast majority of pieces are bowls, either carinated, like here on the left, with the steep straight sides, or with the cavetto shape, generally about this sort of size, about 20 centimetres diameter. But there are also a wide range of other shapes, goblets, trays, ewers, jars, but for the most part it's bowls and a few beakers that we'll be looking at today. In terms of the technique, this is massively blown up. This piece is actually only about that sort of size, so we're dealing with miniature in terms of scale, and we'll come back to that. But what happens is, if you can see here, the outline of the horse or whatever is being depicted is outlined in black, a manganese black on the white glaze, to create a shape in which the glaze colorants can be applied. And what we have here is a deliberately overfired manganese purple, which gives something that's a very mottled effect, which normally you don't want in terms of glaze, but here it gives something that's really looks very close to how a dappled grey horse would look. So this is unique to Minai ware and is very effective as a way of depicting animal skin, particularly used on horses, but as we'll see later, also on camels. After this firing, a more elaborate and detailed outline is added in black over the top of the glaze. And we'll return to this to see where it may have gone a little bit wrong with the blue. But in terms of technique, this is what we're dealing with. So this is an in-glaze colorant that sticks into the glaze, and then the other stuff is painted over the top. In terms of the content of what's depicted, mostly figural decoration, but a not insignificant amount of more vegetal decoration, somewhat akin to how certain manuscripts and Qurans might be decorated. But it's the figural that tends to be the most popular in terms of production. So sort of non-judgmental archaeological sources show there's much more figural, but it's also much more popular in the market. So the market in the early 20th century and in the early 13th century seems to have had very similar taste, be it in Iran or in Paris. They are more appealing. This is one of the most common scenes, the enthroned ruler with symbols of royalty, peacocks, birds of prey, sort of celestial beasts, be they harpies or sphinxes. And these were always billed previously in the literature in the early 20th century as being courtly wares, you know, something that a prince would have held in his very hands, says the person who's trying to sell it for vast amounts of money. But in reality, the princes are going to have gold, silver, inlaid metalwork. They're not going to be having so much of the ceramic ware. And I think the best way to understand what's going on here is their sort of everyday luxury. And we'll see this later with how widely dispersed they are. They're found across not just the Islamic world, but up into the Caucasus and into Russia. And the closest sort of comparison you can think today is the sort of the best china that sits in the cabinet. You know, you've got your coronation plate or your coronation mug, and it's a way for the well-off but not elite to feel some sort of association with this real courtly elite, rather than the prince doesn't need a picture of himself, he knows what he looks like, but this is a way for people to be associated with it. And these are the most common technique that we'll tend to be seeing. And content. In terms of things beyond what's shown, these clear sort of titled rulers sitting enthroned with a nimbus, the most popular scene is Bahramgarh and Azadeh depicted. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this particular part of the Shahnameh story, but I'll quickly summarize it in case anyone hasn't. Bahramgarh, a historical figure, Sasanian king, goes out hunting with his favorite concubine, Azadeh. She's there playing her sort of lyre on the back, and she challenges him to turn a doe into a deer, a deer into a doe, and to pin the hind leg of a deer to its ear with an arrow. And of course, as any good Iranian king knows, he's utterly sort of unchallenged and clearly capable of these wonderful feats. So he proceeds to do it all, does all these things, and then turns to her and said, "You stupid woman, why would you challenge me? I might not have done it," and pushes her off and tramples her to death. He's one of the good guys, so who knows. But what's interesting is this is a piece in the Gulbenkian Museum depicting the scene, but because these things are divorced from the text, so when you're illustrating a text, you can have the narrative running to a point, and at this hinge point, this crucial point, the image can be inserted to give dynamism and sort of excitement to what's happening in the scene. We don't have this in Minai. If they have any meaningful text on them, it's generally a poetic Persian inscription on the outside that doesn't relate to the visual content. The inscriptions in Kufic are usually very generic, often to the point of even being pseudo-Kufic and saying nothing. So it allows a freedom and a different approach to depicting stories. And this piece here is in the Met, has been restored, as any complete piece of Minai, with the exception of a few, has been, but it is largely original. And you can see here we've got two periods of time. So this is something you can't really do in a narrative story because you have the narrative continues in the text and you then need to show the next bit in another image. Here the artists are freed up from this convention. So you can see she's on the back. He's in the process of doing what he's got to do. He turns the doe into a deer by putting two horns in its head. And he turns the deer into a doe by shooting them off, the other one. But here you can see she's then on the ground being trampled to death. So this is something really quite unique in sort of terms of visual representation of stories that is really only seen in a few examples on Minai ware, and is not seen so much in the later manuscript paintings. Of course, this isn't a story created by Ferdowsi, and it's a long tradition in Iranian art of depicting this scene. We have a surprisingly male-looking Azadeh there. He appears to have a moustache, but still the same scene. You can see the arrows in the head there. He's about to do this one. He's not been quite as successful with the ear in this case, but it's quite clearly the same scene. So these are reflecting a long continuity of scenes in Iranian art and Iranian history. And this is just another example showing we do have several of these that have survived. I may have mentioned earlier, my main focus is on fragmentary material, because whatever is missing, which may or may not contribute to our understanding of what's going on, what you have is entirely reliable and authentic. So, you know, the authenticity of what you do have is more important than having something complete in terms of research. In terms of aesthetics and beautiful objects, of course, you want it to be complete. And this is the problem we have, is the intersection of the commercial market for decorative items acquired by great collectors and given to the great museums that then acquire a sort of scholarly interest, but the water has been muddied in advance, unfortunately. There are other seemingly narrative scenes. There's a famous beaker in the Fria, which we'll look at a little later, but this is a piece in the Khalili collection, but again, divorced from the text and fragmentary, it's incredibly different to pin down a specific story or a specific scene. So you can make a case for, oh, this person's, like, you know, they've got a shirt off, they must be a prisoner, could it be that prisoner, could it be another prisoner? But really there comes a point that it's incredibly difficult to be absolutely certain which one of these are. So sometimes I think it just has to be a case of recognising other narrative scenes were depicted, and in its entirety it may have been clearer, and if you're familiar with the material at the time in the 13th century, it may have spoken to you in a way that it just doesn't speak to us now. And this is one of the rarer pieces that has it's been fired upside down, which actually gives you more stability. If you fire a bowl this way up, it can wobble and warp and shift. If you fire it face down, it really can't move very much. The only problem is you can't glaze the rim, and generally there would have probably been brass, copper or silver rim applied in the manner of other Chinese ceramics in this way. The significance of Minai ware in particular is that it really marks the birth of Persian miniature painting. So this style of depicting a sort of Central Asian figure with these long sort of two flowing braids has been seen since Buddhist painting in walls, earlier Islamic monuments in Central Asia. There's nothing new about the depiction style, but it's the miniaturization that's so important. I mean, the one thing to remember, it's all very well doing paintings on works of paper, but these ones you have to then be able to tolerate over 1,000 degrees C in a kiln, so it's a lot harder to execute. But these are truly miniature. I mean, as for example, these fragments from the British Museum, this inscription band is less than 9 millimetres. The figures themselves are less than 3 centimetres high. So this is miniature by really any standard. I mean, far smaller, really, than anything seen in manuscripts until, you know, you get into the sort of Tamas Shahnameh in the centuries following it. Because they're fragmentary, again, we can't know what's being depicted, but it's the technique that's of interest. And there's thousands of these sherds and fragments in the way that there's only sort of 1, 2, maybe 3 manuscripts that can be securely attributed to the late 12th, very early part of the 13th century. So by analysing a large body of work, you can get a much better understanding of how figures, animals, and patterns were being depicted in this sort of miniature manuscript style, even though much later, of course, we have far more manuscripts to work with. But this very early period is why these things are so important to understand, and also why it's important to analyse sherds, because there's no point in analysing the painting technique of something that was painted for the most part in the early 20th century. That doesn't really... it's a very interesting tale, but it doesn't tell you anything about how painting was done in the 13th century. Now, I've mentioned that virtually all pieces that you see in museums that appear to be complete are fictions of varying stages or another, but there are a very few number of pieces. They're all found in Jurjan in northern Iran in a large storage barrel, excavated clearly as a potter's stock or a dealer's stock, ceramic dealer's stock. There's a case to be made that they are different in production. They have a particularly distinctive inscription style, and this motif here, which doesn't appear to crop up elsewhere. So it's possible that they were produced in the city, but needless to say, no evidence to really prove this. So these were mostly acquired by the Addis family. There's one piece in the V&A, a few pieces in the Fitzwilliam Museum now, and the rest are in private hands. But aside from these, any piece of Minai you see, I don't care what anyone says, it's archaeological, it's broken and been glued back together. Sometimes all the pieces are there and they've been glued back together. Others, very little is actually original, and they're an amalgam of various similarly decorated pieces. Now, I've come up with a new taxonomic classification, which you can breathe easy. I'm not going to go through them all. I'll spare you the misery of that. It's a necessary evil to build upon rather than something that's particularly interesting to talk to people about. But it does allow for a much more sort of complex understanding of these wares. So occasionally you'll see style A or style 8 or 7 or something cropping up. Don't worry too much about it. I was just putting it in there to be complete. Now, these things are distributed quite widely. With possibly the exception of lustreware, there's really no other class of medieval Islamic ceramic that is distributed so widely across not just the Islamic world, but far, far to the north, up into Eastern Europe, up the Volga River basin, all across the Levant, as well as, not surprisingly, all across Iran. And this is just a selection of some of the disparate sites that we've been dealing with. It involves trawling through all manner of incredibly exciting archaeological reports, but they do appear. So just to show, rather than go through too many of them, some of these pieces are very crudely executed. There's a very broad range within this category of Minai. Some are clearly very well executed, very intricate, very exquisite, of the finest quality. Others are a little more sort of Primark-y, shall we say, in the same style, same technique, but nothing like the caliber, much rougher, much more quickly executed. The inscriptions are sort of thrown together. The faces aren't very well done. We do seem to find some on the coast, but there's no evidence for a maritime trade in this material. There's nothing seems to crop up where you might expect it in East Africa or anywhere along the Indian coast or further afield. It seems to have been traded either over land or by river up the Volga. We have pieces found in Aleppo, generally in citadels, more where the wealthier people are living necessarily, but not absolutely exclusively limited to the courts, as we can see. Also extends up into the Caucasus. This is quite interesting because it hasn't been repaired. And often when you see repaired, overpainted pieces, they seem overly gaudy. They've thrown sort of the kitchen sink of gold leaf at it, and it seems a bit much. But it does seem they were actually very highly gilded at the time. It just very rarely do you see that much surviving. I've been talking about vessels for the most part, but there are a number of tiles produced. It's a bit of a miniaturist technique, so I don't think it would really work too well at a distance. It's a little bit like this sort of golden hornware in the Isnik tradition. It sort of loses. The further you get away, the less you get anything from it. But it's interesting that pieces produced probably in Kashan, as I say, we're not certain, but they're cropping up in Ray, where this was excavated by Julius Richard, but also way up to the north in Kunya Urgench. This has been reused in a later architectural structure, but it's clearly from a building in that area. There's also quite a lot of pieces found in Dehistan, which you can see just here, also in Turkmenistan there. So it does make the case that there is a single or certainly limited number of production sites when you see these things are just so identical across such a large geographical area. And the furthest afield, I found a piece recently excavated by a friend, colleague Dmitry Voykin, way off almost in the Chinese border in the far east of Kazakhstan in a town called Kayalik. Found in a 13th to 14th century layer, so clearly moved relatively contemporary. Unfinished, it doesn't have the gold leaf of the Taraz. The colours are really, the blue is massively overfired, the turquoise is almost burned off. But there has been some overpaint done, so clearly they thought, well, we're not going to sell it very close, but there's a buyer for everything. If you go far enough, it'll be exotic and we'll find a buyer for it. And it did find its way right over. This is the only piece so far that's been found in the whole of Kazakhstan, but a year or two ago you could have said there's none found in Kazakhstan, so who knows how much is still lurking in the ground. So there's a sort of overview of what Minai is. I didn't go on too long with that. But really what I want to focus on for the rest of what I'm going to talk to you about is how it went from being a class of ceramics that really was completely unknown, completely unpublished, at a time when lustreware was being exhibited at Burlington House and selling for huge amounts of money, racquerware was all the rage soon afterwards, Menai was unknown. Slowly fragmentary pieces appear and then increasingly perfect pieces start appearing as increasing amounts of money. I mean, bear in mind, Edsel Ford paid $35,000 for a Menai bowl in the 1930s. So, I mean, $35,000 would be worth faking now. So you can imagine, I mean, that's like getting $3 or $4 million probably for a bowl. It's no wonder they were sort of throwing these things together as quick as they could dig bits out of the ground. First pieces of Menai to be sort of recorded entering a major collection, South Kensington Museum, the soon to become then the V&A, acquired these in 1868. This is our horse that we were looking at earlier. So you can see how small they are. I mean, the whole piece is that, so the horse is this size. So, I mean, they are really miniature techniques. Generally, bowl bases are what survive because a bowl has a reinforcing ring on the bottom. So if you can sort of chucking buildings on it, that tends to be what survives, apart from odd little bits of the wall. And it tends to be the base that people build up from. Mostly figural, even the seemingly non-figural, if you look closely, actually has got birds in this sort of replication of a star and cross technique. So you see this miniature micro-macro thing going on. So that could be a decoration on a dado wall or a tiny little bowl that sort of transcends scale, which is quite common in a lot of this material. But you can see, again, generally figural in this sort of random selection. These are actually the first pieces of Menai ware to be published, but given that they were never exhibited and sat in a box, and the publication was just a line item saying stone paste figural decoration from Rages, as it was called then, or Ray, it's never really going to set the world alight. Subsequently, more fragmentary but closer to complete pieces. So in 1909, they acquired this piece. No attempt to fabricate or recreate the complete shape, just taking all the pieces that were clearly found together, probably in a well or sort of canut, glue them back together. It is what it is. It's honest enough. You know, sometimes the glue lines become visible over time as the animal glue degrades, but for the most part, it is what it is. Other museums were starting to acquire pieces. This was a little later, in 1945. But the British Museum has a fairly decent collection of fragmentary wares. Duquesne Godman was a real fan of lustreware and particularly interested in collecting Isnik. He wanted to create a representative collection of Islamic ceramics, but for some reason he had no interest in Menai ware. Anytime his excavator, Richard, found some, he just gave it straight to the British Museum. He wasn't interested in it at all, but that's to the British Museum's benefit, I guess. The Louvre also started to buy things. They have a few sherds, but already, even in the early period, they're looking for complete pieces. This was exhibited in Munich in 1910, published in 1912, and after the exhibition was purchased by the Friends of the Louvre Museum and given to them. And again, you can see it seems to be miraculously, perfectly preserved. The Museum for Islamische Kunst, Friedrich Sara was very closely involved in the building up of their collection, and they do have some complete pieces, but they have a particularly representative sherd collection. Not huge, but it really does cover the sort of great majority of styles that exist. There's a few bits and bobs they don't have, but for the most part, this is a good representative collection. By the early 20th century, it's the American museums, and this isn't limited to Menai. I mean, they were hoovering stuff up out of country houses all across Europe. They have a few fragmentary pieces, but they very soon become much more drawn to complete pieces. Now, whether this is what they're looking for, or the fact that collectors are wanting to give them, there's more prestige in giving a big showy piece that'll go on display than a bunch of bits that'll sit in a box, to be fair. So that was in 1912. By 1917, the Fletcher bequest, they acquired this seemingly perfect piece. Now the overpaint's been removed. So they've kept the plaster to see the form of the vessel, but there's sort of a degree of honesty to see what is original and what isn't. But you can see as it was acquired, it appears to be entirely complete. And some of these interventions are a lot clearer now because of the degradation of the colours and the glues and things. So although you can look at it and go, oh, well, that's quite clearly a Spencer's and Nine Bob note, it's had 100 years for these materials to degrade. When they were being presented for sale in the early 20th century and then to the museums a decade or two later, they really did look absolutely perfectly preserved. First piece of Menai to be published in the States, clearly repaired in this case, but ostensibly complete, was these two pieces published by Valentinier in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, in their bulletin. Again, black and white, the whole key thing with Minay is the colour. That's why they stand out so much more than lustreware. I mean, lustre itself doesn't photograph very well, but it's the polychrome effect that's so striking with these things, so black and white publications are only going to raise so much interest. Here's our friend from the Freer. This is, alongside a battle scene plate that they have, is quite possibly the most famous piece of Minay. It's about this sort of size. Depicts what has been identified as Bijan and Manija from the Shahnameh, who is being rescued from the pit. There's a degree of conjecture can be had because there's no text, but it does seem to be quite convincing. It was purchased by Charles Lang Freer from the Arthur Sambon sale in 1914. It was 60,000 francs he paid for it, so it was a fairly decent sum of money back then. It's been probably every 10 or 15 years someone writes an article on this from the 30s through the 50s, the 70s, the 90s, and still no one's ever mentioned the fact that in this 1913 photograph, there's quite clearly an inscription around the top, and now that's been overpainted. It was painted over in the 50s at the Freer, because it actually shows that there was some damage and repair to the rim. So in order to sell the fiction of it being the only perfectly complete piece, it had to cover up the evidence of it not being perfectly complete. So this does appear to be more to say about this thing, hard as that may be to believe after rivers of ink have been spilled over it, but just goes to show you can return to the old favourites and say more, but there's a case to be made for maybe cast the net a little wider. The first visual publication of Minay was in 1907, and it's these pieces that are now in the Louvre but were in the Musée des Arts Décoratifs, with the exception of this one from the British Museum. Small format book, no mention of them in the text, strangely enough, but they are illustrated. But they're never going to set the world on fire. You don't see the scale, you don't see the colour, and even when you see the colour of this particular piece that's in the British Museum, it's a pretty sort of low-rent version. It's not the best, the finest sort of striking example. But nonetheless, it raises the profile and they're being seen in the public eye really for the first time. Dikran Kalekian, one of the many Armenian dealers, the whole of early Islamic art dealer network was primarily Armenians, largely because they were able to go to Paris after the genocide. So they, being Christian, they were welcomed into Paris. They had these networks of connections across the Ottoman Empire, and also they had a large Armenian population in Isfahan. So they had these international networks for trading, and they were bringing material out. He was based in Paris, then opens a store in New York, and he was really one of the main tastemakers. He dealt in all manner of things beyond Minay, but he did have a particular interest in Minay. This is him in his finery at the races in Paris in 1930. Good old eBay for that one. And this is a piece that was one of the first purchases by the Art Fund, actually. He'd lent a huge collection of Minay to the V&A. It was there for probably about 30 years. Until his death, and they wanted to acquire more, but for various reasons couldn't. But this is one piece they do have. And this is another one that was fired upside down. And you can actually see the slight runs in the glaze running seemingly upwards that prove that it was fired upside down and then would have had to have a rim, because if you put it upside down, the glaze would just adhere to whatever it's in. Same sort of standard format. You've got a seated ruler with attendants around it. Unusually, the attendants are larger than the ruler, which is, again, not... not something that we can really explain right now, but is to be observed. And he was someone who was publishing, collecting, and selling. So he sort of sets the tone for this muddying of the waters. He has a sort of an air of academic, but he's quite clearly selling this material, but he's also collecting it for himself. So it wasn't as rigidly defined or divided as it is almost certainly is now, for the most part. One of the earliest publications of Minay, certainly one of the earliest in English, and the first to really get to grips with not just this is a bowl, look at the nice pretty figures on it, but he actually gets to talks about and translates the inscription on it. It's a bowl that he sold to Charles Lang Freer in a few years before, I think in 1907. So he was familiar with it. It's one that had gone through his hands. Black and white's all well and good, but it's not until colour. And these fabulously brightly coloured pieces are... Each plate is about this size. It's from a massive two-volume series that published the a sample of the things from the Meisterwerk Mohammedanische Kunst exhibition held in Munich in 1910, which I'll talk to you about a little bit later. Really fine, fine quality photographs that show these things really to their best advantage. If we look, I'll try to send the whole thing flying. This is where the jaunty figure is quite clearly, the whole upper section is new. No mentions made of that, but it has subsequently been removed. The inscription being upside down at the top does suggest that it wasn't a native Arabic speaker who was performing the restoration either. This is looking perfect. We see it now, it doesn't look quite so perfect, but it does demonstrate how striking these things are when you see them in close to life size and true colour. And bear in mind, in 1912, there weren't a lot of books being sort of produced with this quality of colour reproduction. And these aren't lithographs, these are colour photographs. It was a year later that probably the most striking and important publication to include Minay ware was Henri Rivière's La Céramique dans l'art musulman, was published in Paris. It was the last to include a few fragmentary pieces, but the vast majority were these seemingly perfectly preserved ones. Here's our friend, the Freer beaker, or as it was, the Sambon beaker then. And these were really very lavish productions, limited print runs, only going to be circulating amongst the richest collectors. Even now it'll cost you about £30,000 to buy a copy of this book, much the same for the Sara and Martin catalogue of Munich. So these have never been easily accessible publications. But these were used a little bit like a high-end Argos catalogue by the great collectors. They sort of flick through them and go, well, I want one of those, and I want one of those, and magically one very similar would appear on the market very soon afterwards. Who'd have thought it? Soon afterwards, in 1922, this similarly lavish single collector publication by Riefstahl was published in New York in 1922. And for whatever reason, it's the same format, not quite as thick, very beautiful photographs, but these ones are actually quite affordable. Even the likes of I can afford a copy, so that goes to show how cheap it is. But it starts this tradition of publishing single collectors' holdings. Now, it never does to bite the hand that feeds, so no one's ever critical of these pieces. There's no, this one's a bit dodgy, or that's clearly been overpainted. They're all the finest example of the type, blah, 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 blah. This goes, even now, the Plotnik collection was exhibited in Chicago, a very lavish publication put out by a esteemed scholar. Oh, and what do you know, they're all getting sold at Christie's about a year and a half later at vast expense, with provenance now. So there's a long tradition of this sort of showing things off at their best that muddies the sort of scholarship as to how to really assess these pieces, which is only now slowly being got to grips with. As we move through the 19th into the 1930s, I'm sure there's very few people in the room who aren't familiar with Arthur Upham Pope, really someone who had a deep passion for Iran, the Persian world, its art and architecture, did a great amount of work to record material. His photographs of buildings are unsurpassed, largely because a lot of these buildings either don't exist or don't exist as they were prior to the sort of restoration or urban development in most of the 20th century. Wasn't shy of playing fast and loose with the rules. He was very close friend of Reza Khan, which allowed him to get away with murder. Godard at the time was aware that he was up to no good, but he was untouchable because of his relationship with the Iranian Shah. He was known to smuggle things in through the diplomatic bag, out through the American embassy to circumvent Iranian customs, and thus was able to produce stuff in the market that no one else could get. He would then also write letters, which I'll show you later, about how nothing can come out, so you have to buy it now, sort of thing. This is him embarking on the Queen Mary to another trip to Iran in 1939. His greatest sort of output, along with his wife Phyllis Ackerman, it's always called Pope's Survey, but it really is an Ackerman and Pope's Survey. She wrote a great deal of it and probably did far more editing than he would have done. Still valuable, despite its shortcomings, but our interest lies in the Minay, and here you can see the sort of the way his images depict this ware. Now, he would buy pieces in Iran, have them restored and repaired and painted up, take them to Paris, have more detailed restoration done. And he bought a series of pieces for the Museum of Fine Art in Boston. And when they came, he thought they just needed a bit more work. They didn't look quite right. And the museum were like, no, you can't do that. He's like, you should have seen what I did before. But he's like, no. So he had them photographed and then had the plates painted and touched up before he published them. But he had a rationale behind this. It wasn't just that he was some shady dealer. He thought they should represent the craftsmanship of the people who made them as close as possible. So he did have a rationale. It wasn't just he was some sort of dodgy art dealer. He really thought we should honour the craftsmen who produced them rather than have chipped, broken, worn away, all the gold missing. So his rationale was there, but he also needed them to sell for top dollar. He was always short of money. I mean, he wasn't doing bad things with the money, he was doing great things with the money, but he needed to cultivate these rich collectors to donate to him, and there's constant letters, begging letters, persuading people why they should buy things in order to fund his institute. This letter is particularly interesting. I was working at the Gulbenkian, had a fellowship there recently, and their archives are incredible. But you'll see here, he says, the market is almost wholly shut off from Persia, especially if you can't get things out through the diplomatic bag. It has been for years. Only a few pieces will reach the market. Wonder who buy. But with the publication of the survey, the prices of Persian pottery are going to rocket. And this is him writing to Kalust Gulbenkian to try and sort of persuade him why he should buy things from him now rather than next year. It's the classic salesman, you know, get it now, might not be able to get it later. And he sort of spent his whole time, he seemed to spend his whole time writing begging letters. I'm amazed he managed to get actually research done, never mind the amount that he did do. And that's a segue into looking at the collection of Kalust Gulbenkian. Now, there's quite a lot of wealthy collectors working at the time, but Gulbenkian's really the only one. Not only is his collection still intact, it isn't the largest, but it is a significant one, but the archive around how they were all acquired is intact, which means we can see the network of primarily Armenian dealers, of which there's dozens, and he's an Armenian himself. Gulbenkian controlled 5% of the world's oil reserves, so he was the richest man in the world. He could buy whatever he wanted. He generally bought the absolute finest, perfect, best of the best, whether it was sculpture, paintings, manuscripts from Europe or the Middle East. But the only fragmentary, broken, incomplete things he bought were early in his collecting career and fragments of Minai. He trusted his eye and he knew what was good. And he eventually fell into the common mistake of thinking well-provenanced, published, and perfect was the way to go. And with most art, that's true. But with Minai, it's the death knell. Because the better the collector, the more published, and the greater the exhibitions and institutions that hold it, the more likely it is to be mostly plaster and overfill. But he was buying fragmentary pieces, of which there were probably no shortage of in the early 20th century, but he bought very unique, specific ones. This was the lot after the Freya beaker, and for whatever reason, although it's not that he couldn't afford it, he chose to buy the fragmentary one, partly because it was 2,000 francs rather than 60,000, but he bought the partial one over the complete, and he bought this from Kalabjian. But what happens is there's a shift. He goes from personally buying from colleagues, friends, fellow Armenians who are dealers, to getting agents to buy at auction from existing sales. So there's a remove away from the directness. And as he does this, he starts buying complete pieces. He gets two or three. When they arrive from London or from Paris, he looks at them and he said, these are utter rubbish. I mean, you can see they're all patched together. I mean, they just don't look good even now. You can see there's something wrong. And he never bought another one. He bought dozens, if not hundreds, of pieces of Iznik and Sultanabad, but he never touched Minai again afterwards. He was burned once or twice, and that was enough. This is a selection of some of the pieces. He's got this, as I used it earlier. This pierced sort of forerunner of Gebrunware, the lots of pierced white Seljuk ware, but this is the only example I've ever come across where it's on a piece with Minai, and it's not like it's been added later because it does just go around the horse and the figure. It sort of acts, if you hold it up, that's where the photo's a bit funny because I'm holding it up with a light behind it to show the light shining through, and then when you put it down, it's got the starburst on it, so the image is reflecting the reality of how it can be perceived. So there's something quite interesting going on. This is the only, it's fragment, but it's the only example of an entirely, purely epigraphic Minai, no other one. This is a very large and interesting Bahram Gur. This is a piece that really shows this transition between what would, if it was just that piece, you'd say, oh, definitely late 13th, early 14th century Lajvardina, but it's got the horse, it's got the body, it's got the red decoration. So it's showing that there is a transition. There wasn't one, then the other. So again, he spies this as being interesting and important. And these records show this difference. It goes from him buying from Calebdew and Frères fragments of faience of Ray in multiple colours. Subsequently, he has his agents buy from Galerie Georges Petit from the Engels Gross sale. So he wants something with provenance, and he ends up with a seemingly complete piece, a lot more money, 31,000 francs. But it's along with a whole bunch of other stuff. He's not like, oh, I just want to go and get Minai. He's like, you know, there's lots of very good French silver coming out as a result of the Russian Revolution that has been in Russia, lots of furniture, medieval maize. He's sort of hoovering stuff up. And you can actually see a graph between the price of oil and the amount of stuff he buys. So even though he's richer than Croesus, it still is like, oh, oil's up, okay, I'll spend a bit more this month. And so, you know, he watched the pounds, as it were. But this was one of the pieces, and he bought another white piece, and shortly afterwards, and when you see them, they're really, really rough. They got flooded, actually, in the 50s after he died, and all fell apart because the animal glue dissolved. So they had to glue them back together again. So that removed any doubt as to how problematic they are. So here we can see he's bought this piece at the Sambon sale, but it's interesting that the two pieces that he buys at the Sambon sale both are featured in Henri Rivière's catalogue. So he has a copy of this book, and he's gone through it, and he's seen these pieces that have interested him for whatever reason, and then as soon as they come on the market, he acquires them. Does the same with this piece. It's unique. He spots it. It comes up for sale, and he acquires it. He also buys a bowl, and for some reason, he used two different agents. So he had Calebdian as an agent buying some pieces, and he had Grattan Madeley buying other things at the same sale. This is actually quite good. You can see it's discoloured here, that this bit is a plaster infill, but for the most part it's complete. But because it's not figural, you can see how much cheaper it is. So, you know, he was paying the fragment of the beaker, a broken bit, was almost the same price as an almost perfectly complete bowl, but doesn't have the figural decoration. So that the market is really sort of dictating a far greater value on figural art and figural examples than it does on the non-figural, even though, I mean, to me, this is actually one of the finest pieces in his collection. Also acquired this that we saw earlier. Let's see, this piece published in Zara and Martin's catalogue in 1912, and he's actually, there's a small slip of paper marking three of the images in the book, placed there by Gulbenkian, and this is the one he's marked out. So he's like, I want one of those. You can't get that exact one. This one comes up for sale privately soon afterwards in London, and he acquires it along with a couple of other pieces. So you can see he's using these things as a catalogue. But these are circulating around a very, very small elite strata of the wealthiest people in the world. I mean, he's going up against Charles Lang Freer and his rich industrialists. This isn't something the wider public are aware of. It's with the exhibitions, the public exhibitions, that the broader public start to see these things and become aware of them, and they start being brought together and also published in more sort of reasonable priced publications, in the way that now, you know, we can all afford an exhibition catalogue, you know, 10, maybe £20, but you know, you can take home your memory of it. First major exhibition to include Minai. There'd been other examples, other exhibitions of Islamic art, but it's this one in Munich, the Meisterwerk Mohammedanischer Kunst in 1910, and this really marks the birth of this sort of white cube style gallery. Before, especially Islamic art, Oriental art, had been this sort of bizarre effect, you know, carpets piled up, people dressed up in funny sort of turbans and curly slippers. This is the first time where it's really stripped back. Lots of empty space, objects allowed to speak for themselves with a small textbook, which really dictated how all exhibition spaces have been really up till today. I mean, it's a very modern-looking space. It doesn't look like it's an exhibition from more than 100 years ago, except maybe some of the vitrines. Here you can see the cracks have appeared back from the piece when we saw it earlier. It was in the exhibition and purchased by Friedrich Sara for the museum in Berlin. Arthur Upham Pope's behind organising this big exhibition of Persian art with Reza Shah's support. Huge amounts of tile work are stripped out of various shrines, which was technically illegal, but when you're the Shah, you can do this. They all came to London, and then when they went back to Tehran, they went straight to Reza Shah's palace. Various pieces, this particular one's now in the Fitzwilliam, but lots of pieces in the public sphere now have lots of little stickers, so we can see that they have this sort of provenance of where they were displayed in this exhibition. Tens of thousands of people visited it. It was just around the corner from here in Burlington House. Several very small but well-illustrated publications were put out, so a lot of people were aware of it. Here's a list of some of the books that were available at the time, quite reasonably priced. And, I mean, bearing in mind that this is at the height of the sort of purges and the terror, somehow Pope persuaded the Soviets to have the Third International Congress of Persian Art, along with a huge exhibition in what is now St. Petersburg in Leningrad. For probably doctrinal reasons, it's not an example of Islamic art that's depicted on the stamp promoting it by the Soviet authorities. But needless to say, there was a lot in there. The promotional literature is a little harder to find. The catalogue, there is a catalogue that I've seen for it, but it's just a line item description. There's no illustrations in it. So it's a little hard to be certain because the terminology is often quite hard to determine exactly if it is Minai. But we know there was a lot of pieces in there. A lot of private collection was absorbed in the early Soviet period and went to the Hermitage, including the Stieglitz one. And the final exhibition, before we have a few minutes to talk about the restoration, here's Pope again at the 6,000 Years of Persian Art exhibition in New York, showing a piece to Helen Keller, actually. So she's a famous blind, deaf-mute woman who obviously feeling a candlestick to get a sense of it. And it's by this point that you can really see it's really broadly, widely known. The public have seen them. They're widely published. And a few years later, we have Pinder Wilson's publication with, you know, 10% of the entirety of Islamic art in every media devoted to Minai. Now, we come to the crux of it. I should be able to run through this in about 5 minutes. I've seen, as mentioned, plaster fills the easiest and most common intervention. But given the value of these things, and if you want them to pass the ring test, you just flick a ceramic, it's got a certain ring that plaster won't have. This piece here, much to the chagrin of the curator when I pointed it out to them, what's happened is a whole bowl has been made out of stone paste, decorated in Minai, fired in the early 20th century, and then the piece they needed is cut and attached in. So they break it into pieces so it fits in with the sort of crack lines of the others and put it together. But you can see the red is just, it's too well preserved. There's not enough on it. And with the inscription band, it's all just the perfect red outline. Whereas on the original section, there's very little of the red survives, but there are traces of the gilding. So you know, you just have to look at these things with a critical eye. The bird's a bit questionable as well. But it passed muster for, you know, best part of 100 years. And this is one of the most sort of expensive, but relative to the cost, you know, worth doing interventions because it is all ceramic. The other approach is to take a very cheap monochrome bowl, of which you can buy even now for £100, paint the overglaze onto it, and it'll pass a TL or thermoluminescence test because it was last fired in Iran in the 13th century. It just was decorated, you know, paint still wet sort of thing. There was some question about these things, even in the 30s. People were saying some of these things that Pope's trying to force into the Burlington House are questionable, but he sort of railroaded them, and nobody was too certain. No one really wanted to rock the boat. Now that I've got a job, I can rock the boat. I don't care anymore. I don't want to work in a museum, so I don't care. In the 1950s, Murray Pease was hired by the Met, and he was the first to use technologies like X-ray to go, hang on, what's really going on with these things? We need to understand. And when you start X-raying these things, it becomes quite apparent what's going on. You can also use ultraviolet. And this is as it goes into the museum, acquired in 57, and this is one they've used as a sort of test case, and they've taken all the overpaint and the fill out. These pieces look suspiciously like they're newly fired and cut in. This is original, but obviously you can see how much of the decoration has abraded over the near millennia that it spent shattered in the ground. Another way of looking at it, this one comes into the museum in 1913, seems to be a fabulous piece. UV, radiograph, and this is an edited digital copy of what is original. So this one doesn't even have the bowl base, but it still remains on display as it looks. The Met have this sort of thing, they've spent a lot of time investigating some of their pieces, publish what's wrong with them, and then other curators don't seem to read that and publish them as complete in other books. So they're getting there. There is a process towards understanding this, but it does mean every time you find out what's going on, you basically have to take it off display. So if they look at everything, they'd have to take everything off display. So, you know, it makes sense not to do that. And this is a particularly egregious example. This hasn't been published. I'm working with the conservator on this, actually, in Houston at the moment. She was asked to sort of take it back to what was original, got to this point, panicked, and got in touch with me and was like, help, what am I supposed to do? Afshar's going to lose his mind when he sees what I've done to his jug. But this is the one very rare example that's not stone paste. It's a green-grey clay, and it's unglazed. So these are the only unglazed examples with glazed decoration. So it's just this band here, these bands here, and some of the turquoise. And again, you've got this sort of Lajvardina type look. And the reason for this, you only see this in jugs. There's only four or five that I'm aware of this type. But it allows the water to be cooled and sweetened by the taste of the clay. So it's specifically functional. It needs this function of being able to breathe, but it's clearly a more luxurious version. So the idea that, you know, unglazed wares aren't luxury, here's the proof that they are. But it shows just how much intervention is going on with these things. I mean, this is what's sort of reliable, and that's how it has appeared subsequently, you know, up to that point. And I'll end with this image here, which Oliver Watson was really instrumental in sort of having this done to the bowl and then put on display so that people really can start to understand. And because this style, I call it a style two, this sort of white background reserve inscription is among the most common. You can find dozens of sherds of them, and there's stories of oil drums full of sherds of different types in the pottery workshops in Iran, even in the 60s and 70s. But what they do is they shave them down. So if you've got the decoration you want on the inside, shave the back off, find one that you want for the outside, shave the front off, sandwich them together. You can see this one's got a little bit more decoration, but I can paint over that. Clearly, the colours don't match, the birds inserted. You know, they are an amalgam, and this is what most pieces of Minai, this is a particularly egregious example, but this is what most pieces of Minai that we see in museums and coming up for auction at the great auction houses or published in the great books, most of them really look like this at heart. So it's not to say it's anything bad, it's just a fact. We need to be honest about it. It's quite interesting. I mean, it's got more of a story than one that's seemingly perfect. But that's where I'm going to end it. So thank you very much.
Well, it's only left to me to just to say thank Richard very much for that fantastic survey. Very interestingly connecting up with collecting and exhibitions of a subject, a type of wear that was fashionable once, less fashionable now. Actually, you can't buy it at all. But let's shine a spotlight on it, and I look forward to your book. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Something a little stronger.